Wake Up with Hannah.
Good morning. Joining us on the line now from the UK is John Murphy. He founded Interbrand in 1974. It was initially a name creation business with early jobs including the creation of Mondeo, Hobnobs, Homebase, Viagra and Punto. In 1979, he opened in New York, 82 in Paris and Frankfurt, and in 83 in Tokyo. Brand Father is the story of Interbrand, as told by John Murphy, the man who invented branding. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you.
Hi, it's lovely to have you with us. So tell us about those initial early stages back in the 70s when you started Interbrand. What was it all about back then?
Well, I was desperate to work for myself, and I didn't have a big idea at first. I was working for Dunlop, and I couldn't really go into the tire manufacturing business. And I had a problem when I was with Dunlop finding an international brand name for a new tire, because everything I came up with either didn't work in one language or another, and we were an international business, or once I got a name that everybody liked, I took it along to my trademark people and they said it wasn't legally available. So eventually we got there, but I thought, well, here's a business idea. Britain was just, newly into the common market and trying to trade in international markets. So I thought, well, people are going to need international brand names and they might pay me to come up with them. So that was my big idea. But, as often happens with those things, I thought it was a big idea, but other people didn't. So the first few years were really very thin and I had to persist.
And I find it interesting, the whole idea of coming up with a name. I mean, when it's when the name says a lot about what the product does. So Homebase, for example, you get products for the home there. It's a base where you can buy places. Do you know what I mean? It works. It adds up. But when you've got something like, well, I don't know, Mondeo, I suppose. I'm not aware of Mondeo meaning anything, but I know straight away exactly what it is and the brand and the car. And how do you come up with words that aren't necessarily connected to the product?
Well, we used groups of consumers. We found people who are very good with words, who have a good language base. And we'd sit them around a table and put a couple of bottles of wine in the middle, and we'd pay them a fee, and they'd come up with names. I mean, oftentimes the names they came up with weren't necessarily names that we could use, but we could then sit at a desk and take bits of those names and splice them together. Or else they came up with ideas, with themes that we could then take further. For example, somebody said, what about, or somebody would say, what about an old English name, a name from the 18th century? And they try and think of one. And later we'd go away and buy a book of English slang and look at that. So it was a sort of creative process using consumers, but also using desk research. And later we developed computer programs for splicing words together. And we also got a huge database, of course. We'd be working on one project, naming a world car, and then later we'd have to name a new drug. And we'd look at, lists that we'd come up with of names for a car and see whether they'd work for a drug. And sometimes they might not work exactly, but we could modify them and they would.
It's very clever how it works and how people make that decision that says, yes, this is going to work and this is a good name. I'm also interested in rebranding and how and why that happens. I'm thinking particularly of Marathon becoming Snickers, Opal Fruits becoming Starburst. Why do companies change their names?
Well, often they do it because they've got it a bit wrong the first time round. Companies many years ago would start off by launching a new product and they'd think of a name for it that worked in the UK, for example. And then the product would have appeal worldwide. And they might then find they have to use a different name in France or in Spain or in the United States. And that name, which was more carefully chosen, might become a much, much more international name than the original name, say, in the UK. And then eventually they say, this is daft. You know, people now travel the world. They don't just live in the UK.
Mm.
They go on their holidays to different countries. They get homes in different countries. You know that far better than I do. We want to make it uniform. And it could well be that the original name is then the name that's least used. And so they'll take the name used elsewhere and extend it and use it in all countries.
Mm. And when we talk about branding, now it's so much more than just the name, isn't it? That, you know, advertising and social media and marketing, there's so much more that comes with under the umbrella of branding.
Yes, I mean, we really invented that. I mean, what started to happen was that companies would give us a brief and say, this is the sort of name that we want. One example of that was the Hobnobs project, which was a British company called United Biscuits. They wanted us to come up with a really seriously boring descriptive name. And when we held our groups of consumers and they tried the product, they sat round, but they thought the product was fabulous. And their view was that the brief given us by our client to come up with a boring sort of descriptive name, you know, crunchy something or others, was just doing the product no favors at all. And they said to us, in effect, they didn't say it in as many words, that they wanted a name that was much more fun and much more about the personality of the product than about a description of the sort of qualities of the product.
Mm.
And I can remember going back to the company, to United Biscuits, and said, look, you've got the wrong idea about this product. You've got to give it a name with much more personality. And that's how Hobnobs came about. They eventually, and very reluctantly, I should tell you, accepted my recommendation. And increasingly, I realized that we weren't just about thinking up names. Our job was thinking up personalities for products.
Yes.
And then I decided in the 1980s to write a book, and I called the book Branding, and the word had never been used before. I remember I came up with this name, this title for the book, Branding, and came back to the office and said, you know, we're now in the branding business. This book is going to be called Branding. And they all thought I was loopy. My colleagues all fell about. And the idea of brands and branding didn't really exist then. And we really created this whole idea that brands have personality and they're much more than just mere names. But certainly until the 1980s, people just wanted names that they could register and protect and that didn't mean anything horrid in strange languages, Swahili or Korean. And then they started thinking that we're giving this product personality. And we put that idea into their heads. And that's where the whole thing's taken off from.
Yes. And what's so clever is when TV campaigns particularly that people see and you get the visual aspect of characters, and these characters are associated with brands. So, you know, whether it was the mashed potato, what was it called? Smash.
Yes, that's
and those
right.
And those tin characters, the monkeys for PG Tips and the meerkats and things like that, they can make a huge, huge difference. And people, the public, can fall in love with these characters, which is great, I guess. You're,
well, exactly right. I mean, the other curious thing was that the people who poo-pooed us most in the 1970s and 1980s and were very superior and sort of patted me on the head and said, you know, funny little business you've got there, John, were the ad agencies. And
okay.
They thought of themselves as simply taking product names and spreading them as widely as they could. And this whole idea about building personalities, they didn't subscribe to it at all. In fact, they were very snotty about it. And so it's funny, and it's good that they've taken it up now with such sort of alacrity.
Yes. So you've, with Interbrand starting in 1974, you're now literally all over the world, aren't you?
That's right. I think, I mean, I sold the business, so it's not me. I'm a sort of gentleman of leisure now. But
lovely.
But by the time I sold it, I think we were in 14 countries, and now they're in 24 countries.
Fantastic. And one of the things you talk about in the book is the sort of doomed merger of two of Europe's largest companies, creating a monster with 200,000 employees. Tell us about that.
Well, I was in the thick of it. This is my job before I started Interbrand. I was working for Dunlop, and on my first day, I was working in head office in London. The managing director, a chap called John Simon, introduced himself and said, look, don't get involved in anything else. I'm going to have a job for you. And at the end of the week, he called me in, and I'd been sitting on my hands for a week. He said, we're merging with Pirelli, and Dunlop had 100,000 employees, and Pirelli had 100,000 employees. We're merging to create this huge business with 200,000 employees, and we've got a lot of sorting out to do. And you're going to work for me as my right-hand man, and you're going to, you're effectively going to be my sort of leg man doing all the legwork on negotiating with Pirelli and pulling this all together. And I said to him, why are we doing this? And he said, well, they're very big in tyres, and we're very big in tyres, so we'll be even bigger in tyres. I said, but, we're in countries like Germany and France and Japan and the United States and Canada and Australia, and they're in Turkey and they're in Portugal and they're in Italy, all of which, this is in the 1970s, were very troubled places to trade. And he said, well, should be all right. The company was entirely offhand about it. And, what it was all about, I sort of came to realize, was that the Brits thought that they were simply superior to the Italians. And it wasn't really going to be a merger. It was going to be Dunlop taking over the world because we were Brits and they were not. And it turned out, of course, to be a complete disaster.
Gosh, interesting time. So when did you sort of come out of the business then?
Well, I came out. I went in 1969 and I came out in 1974 and started Interbrand the same year.
And when did you stop branding altogether?
Well, I sold Interbrand in 1994. And I've become a brand owner myself.
Okay.
And I use some of my ill-gotten gains. I started two new branded goods businesses. I started a brewery, which I still own, called St. Peter's Brewery in Suffolk. And we make English ales. And we employ quite a few people. We sell all over the world. And it's great fun. So I did that. And then I also started, more recently, a brand of male grooming.
Oh, wow.
Well, we started with a chain of barber shops, and we won all the prizes, best barber shop in the world, all that sort of stuff.
Fantastic.
And then we've called Ruffians. And then we've launched a range of male grooming products, shampoos and hair oils and beer oils and matte clay. But I also bought, I didn't start it, I bought Plymouth Gin.
Okay, yeah.
And I owned and ran that for quite a few years, but we sold that on to Absolut Vodka. So I've gone from being a branding consultant to being a brand owner.
Fantastic. And you've managed to combine beer and grooming products, which is very impressive.
Yes. But they're separate businesses. But I'm chairman of both of them.
Yes. No, but you said you got beer in hair products as well.
Oh, no, we don't. We haven't put beer into the products. No, we didn't do that.
Oh, I thought you'd said there was a beer product.
No, there's not a beer male grooming product.
Oh, okay.
Beer's a bit sticky,
Yeah, so, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, if people want to find out more about your very interesting story, the book is called Brand Father, and it's by John Murphy, who we've been chatting to today. The book is available to buy on our website, Talk Radio Europe, in the bookshop section. John, thank you so much for joining us. Really interesting chatting with you.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Now, more than ever, we're your voice in Spain. Talk Radio Europe.